Welcome, members and guests, to the September 19th program of the City Club of Eugene. Greetings to our broadcast audiences on community television, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Our program title today is What Will Move Oregon Education Forward? I'm Marlene Nessery, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students in grades 7 through 12, Essex General Construction, a developing partnerships as strong and sturdy as the buildings they construct, and KRVM, listener-supported public radio. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and archiving the broadcasts on their website. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please consider becoming a City Club donor, sponsor, regular, or virtual member. We're pleased to welcome new members Charis Magahi and LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens of Lane County, and the LULAC Youth Council. We welcome as well our new sponsor, the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. Our topic today is what will move education forward. Immediately following the main presentation, we'll have two first questioners, Zelda Lopez-Haro, Education Chair at LULAC, and Eric Richardson, President of NAACP. Now here to introduce today's speaker, current 4J Superintendent Sheldon Berman, is former City Club President Mary Layton. Thank you.
So when Shelly first came to town a few years ago, I looked him up, you know, I Googled him, then I looked up in the various other more formal references, and I realized this must be a pretty substantial fella, because my brother and sister-in-law spent their careers teaching in Louisville Public Schools, and I knew that was not an easy assignment, because there are many, well, it's not as bad as Eugene, but it's very difficult. Politics in Louisville are very hard. And then he came from a small district, relatively speaking, and so I knew he's got some grit. He is the founder and president of Educators for Social Responsibility, another reason to think this is a guy with some meat on his bones and professionally and willing to take a challenge. And those are important values, especially for Eugene, and they're particularly appealing to people who come to City Club because we're all about social responsibility, and most of us are massively overbooked. So he's one of us. He is the author of books, a couple of books, Children's Social Consciousness, Promising Practices and Teaching Social Responsibility. He has published articles on civic education, character education, service learning, virtual education, and education reform. He is a member of the Education Commission of the State's National Center for Learning and Citizenship. For 14 years, he was the superintendent of Hudson Public Schools, 4 years of Jefferson County Public Schools, and he's been here since Louisville. The weather's much better here. He has a PhD and an MED from that little place on the other side, a suburb of Hudson, Boston, Harvard University. another one from the University of Maine, and he went to UW-Madison. So this is a guy with some pretty good credentials. So the reason I point all that out is because he's talking about looking forward, and we need to ask ourselves, what do we care what he thinks? We're asking a person to talk about the subject. We need to think, who is it that's making these ideas up? So he's a guy who's a little bit younger than me, so he could be thinking about retiring. Lots of educators think about retiring after 30 years because the pension's not bad. But he's still looking for new challenges, and I am interested to see what this deep and wise professional guy thinks we ought to do. Where should we go from here? So here he is, Shelly Berman.
Thank you, Mary, and that's really a wonderful introduction. In fact, I'm glad you specified that meat on my bones wasn't just was, you know, the substance. So thanks. And thanks, City Club, for inviting me back. This is my third time here, third time speaking, so I guess I didn't do too badly the first two. So thank you for the re-invitation. You know, just 4 years ago, Governor Kitzhaber announced a bold goal that by 2025, 40% of adult Oregonians will be holding a bachelor's degree, 40% will have earned an associate degree or a technical certificate, and 100% will have completed high school. To achieve this goal of 40-40-20, as we become accustomed to referring to it, he set in motion changes in governance and in the administrative structure of education in the state, in the standards that both students and teachers have to meet, in funding for education, and also in the targeted group of strategic initiatives that the state is pursuing. I've titled this talk, What Will Move Oregon Education Forward, purposely, because I would argue that the governor set an appropriate target as well as high-leverage strategies to reach that target. He has appointed the right people to carry out that plan, with Nancy Golden as our chief academic officer of the state and Rob Saxton to lead the Oregon Department of Education. And I know you heard from Nancy Golden just weeks ago, in fact. Under their leadership, we are beginning to see positive change. It's a bit too early to have significant turnaround, but the signs of progress are clearly present. I would also argue that there are a number of additional strategies that are critical to reaching that goal. But first, in order to know in what direction to move, we have to know where we are. That picture for Oregon is not a pretty one. Over the past year, there have been a series of studies that have compared state results and ranked states on a variety of critical factors. The picture they paint for Oregon is disturbing. I will weave these rankings throughout this talk, but let me begin with the bottom line. The percent of adults who currently meet the 40-40-20 standard. Education Week's Quality Count study of 2014 ranked Oregon 30th among states in post-secondary participation and degree attainment. In 2010, only 29% of adults had a bachelor's degree, as opposed to the 40% goal. And only 27% had an associate or technical certificate, as opposed also to the 40% goal. And sadly, 11% of our population didn't have a high school diploma. Clearly, 30th among states is not where we want to be, and we have a long way to go to reach the 40-40-20. However, what is more troubling is that Oregonians aren't just failing to finish college. We're not even finishing high school. We're ranked 46th in graduation rate, with a graduation rate in Oregon that is 12% below the national average. You may say, well, that's a sign of where we have been, but not a sign of where we will go. In some ways, you would be right. However, even the current data on early childhood education and performance in the early grades are concerning. The Quality Count study ranked Oregon 42nd in preschool enrollment and 36th in kindergarten enrollment. Our fourth grade scores on NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is sort of the national test that all states participate in, ranked us 32nd in math and 33rd in reading. However, even more concerning is that in the past 10 years, from 2003 to 2013, we made far less growth in our NAEP scores than other states. In terms of the change in average scores, or our improvement over that 10-year period of time, we ranked 45th among states in math and 38th among states in reading. For economically disadvantaged students, we ranked dead last in improving NAEP results over the last 10 years. Oregon is also one of the shortest school years, one of the highest chronic absentee rates, that is, students missing more than 10% of the school year, and one of the highest overall absence rates of any state. Our average school year is less than the legal minimum for every state except Colorado, and we tie with Idaho for the lowest number of required instructional hours. For a state that prides itself on education, you may find these results shocking. However, they reflect our financial investment in education. The Quality Count study found that Oregon ranked 46th in state expenditures on K-12 education as a percent of state taxable resources. In 1997, Oregon ranked 15th among states in per pupil spending. By 2010, we had sunk to 34th. spending 12% below the national average. When adjusted for inflation, Oregon is spending 30% less on education than it did in 1990. That's not a good picture. What do we need to do, and what are we going to do to change these results? Obviously, adding $1 billion to the biennial education budget over the past 2 years is a great help, but it still leaves us far behind financially. More funding is critical, but it isn't just more funding, but how that funding is strategically used that is even more important. So in what do we invest? I would suggest that there are 7 critical initiatives or investments we need to pursue. The first, the most significant long-term strategy, has to be an investment in early childhood education and full-day kindergarten. Children need these early experiences with highly qualified teachers to prepare them both academically and socially for the more rigorous academic work they have ahead of them. They need the pre-reading, vocabulary, and rich experiences through structured play and investigation of the world around them that that quality preschool can provide. They need to develop the social skills to work and to play well with others so that they can come into kindergarten and first grade classrooms understanding the social norms of the classroom and be ready for the interesting and challenging tasks of the academic curriculum. The state will be requiring full-day kindergarten next year, and hopefully they'll be funding it as well so that it doesn't further compromise the education of students in grades 1 through 12. In Eugene, we're eagerly preparing for the move to a full-day kindergarten and are working with the United Way on a critical early education program for economically disadvantaged children. This represents a good beginning, but it's only a first step. Several states have implemented early childhood programs for all 3- and 4-year-olds, and that has to be the future direction for Oregon as well. Second, we need to prepare our students to meet higher expectations and more rigorous standards. When you compare our previous system of standards, which was called OAKS, and to other assessments across the country, we rank as one of the least rigorous. And as you can see in the chart, these are the rankings of the system, the relative difficulty of the system. And you can see Oregon ranks near the bottom of the 50 states in math. And if you go to reading, we rank second to last in terms of the rigor of our test. One of the most long-term beneficial initiatives of the state is that it has adopted the Common Core state standards and the new Smarter Balance test that will assess students against more rigorous standards aligned to college and career readiness. I support these standards and assessments because they focus student learning on key concepts and higher order thinking rather than just remembering facts and procedures. And this will serve our students well in post-secondary education and in careers. The new state standards challenge students to use information rather than repeat it. We will have a tough adjustment as scores drop initially in response to the tougher standards and testing, but the result will be higher levels of instruction to meet the challenge, and our students will be better off as a result. These new standards and assessments need to be embraced, supported, and fully implemented. They represent the targets our students need to achieve to meet the 40-40-20 goal. Third, we need to invest in enhancing the capacity of teachers to deliver high-quality instruction. Over the years of recession, the first area of expenditure to go has been professional development. However, without it, teachers can't stay current with new instructional strategies and all of the new state requirements and initiatives. They can't collaborate with peers to move instruction forward. The state has set aside $5 million for a strategic initiative around educator effectiveness. This initiative provides districts with funding for critical professional development for their faculties. It also holds districts accountable through the required implementation of a new teacher evaluation system. In Eugene, we've used our federal and state grant resources on professional development, focused on high-leverage instructional strategies, as well as on implementation of a teacher evaluation system that asks teachers to focus on and document their professional growth. It's not the kind of classic gotcha evaluation system, but a system that encourages collaboration, reflection, and continuous improvement. This is both a short-term and a long-term investment that will pay dividends in student results for many years to come. In fact, I believe we and Eugene have provided the most focused, best quality professional development we could possibly deliver for long-term results. Fourth, we need to change our strategies for closing the achievement gap. And that isn't just for students of color or for those who are economically disadvantaged. We have to focus on students who are learning English for the first time, and for our special education students as well. We have to first admit that we have not been successful, and then we have to acknowledge that unless we make progress in closing the achievement gap, we can't be successful in achieving our broader goals. So what does it take? First, there's no one intervention that will fix this. Not any intervention at a particular grade level or in a particular subject area. The work we're doing in culturally proficient teaching is a critical start, but we need to do more than that. In order to make a difference, we need a continuous stream of interventions that begin with targeted preschool programs, extended day and extended year programs once those students are in school, and programs in the middle and high school like AVID, which stands for the Advancement Via Individual Determination, that are specifically targeted to prepare students to study more effectively, persist when faced with more rigorous and challenging academic work, and be prepared for the challenges they will meet in post-secondary education. And I believe most recently last year, you heard a presentation on AVID and on BEST, which is another program that supports our students who are both economically disadvantaged and have other challenges. We need to support bilingual and dual language programs to support our English language learners, and a renewed focus on the effective integration of special education students in the regular classroom. And we need to engage parents. In Eugene, we've made a strong commitment to our BEST after-school program, which this year will enroll 600 students at the elementary and middle school level, and an AVID, which is now in all our middle schools and all our high schools. We have restructured our two Spanish immersion elementary programs so that they are high-quality experiences both for Spanish and English language learners, and we've extended Spanish immersion into the middle school in the North region. We're visiting the homes of our students as well as more fully engaging parents and providing them with support they need to get more involved in their child's education. These represent a first step for us, but more needs to be done so that we follow through and support students from pre-K to graduation and beyond. Fifth, I would be remiss if I didn't identify reducing class size as a critical need to enhance student performance. We know that personalizing education for our students, that is individualizing so that each student is challenged at an appropriate level, is the best way to move students forward. However, in order for teachers to differentiate their instruction for groups of students in their classroom, study student work so that they understand what students have learned and what misconceptions and challenges they still face, and then adjust their instruction accordingly, takes time and a manageable class size. In the same way, special education teachers need manageable caseloads so they can effectively help students integrate into the regular classroom and maintain progress. Currently, our class sizes are far too large, not only in Eugene, but across the state. In fact, Oregon has the third largest class size average in the country. Classes of over 30 at the elementary level and of nearly 40 at the middle and high school do not provide optimum conditions for learning. Reducing class size is the most significant intervention we can make, as long as teachers use that opportunity to personalize and individualize instruction. Excuse me. Sixth, as I indicated at the beginning, Oregon has one of the shortest years in the country and provides one of the least amounts of instructional time. A recent analysis by COSA, which is the administrator's organization in the state, revealed that over the course of grades 1 through 12, Oregon students received 919 fewer hours, and that equates to 153 fewer days of instruction than the national average. However, it is even more dramatic if you compare us just with our neighbor state of Washington. Oregon students receive 1,590 fewer hours from grades 1 through 12, or approximately 265 fewer days of instruction than students in Washington. That equates to about a year and a half of instruction for Oregon students. That doesn't take into consideration all the lost days due to furlough days that districts have had to take as a result of the loss of school funding. Over time, we need to add 10 more days to the school year and even lengthen the school day. However, we also need to make better use of the time we have. When I came to Eugene, I discovered that only 32% of our high school students had a full schedule. It's often that the students who had a full schedule were the ones who were most assertive. That not only compromised the quality of students' education, but it also had a significant impact on graduation rates, particularly for students who had academic challenges. As students failed to secure sufficient credits, they became less hopeful and less engaged, and then failed to graduate and dropped out. This is not only the case for Eugene, but all over Oregon. However, in Eugene, we've dramatically changed that. Not only are virtually all our ninth graders fully scheduled, but last year, 73% of all our high school students had a full schedule as a result of the efforts of administrators and actually the capacity of the new common high school schedule that we've implemented. The changes we've made at the high school level in Eugene, full schedules, a common high school schedule, a new math program, expansion of AVID, and others are paying off. We saw gains in our state test scores at the high school level, and we also saw a closing of the achievement gap for almost all demographic groups of high school students. Seventh and last, we need to reimagine grades 11 through 14 so that there's no boundary between high school and post-secondary education. Students need to acquire college credits in high school and have opportunities to be on college campuses to take courses as well. We need to provide students who are interested in technical careers to take courses at the community college that prepare them for a technical certificate or associate degree, so that then when they formally enter community college or a technical program, they're on the road to success. This is already happening here in Eugene. Lane Community College now hosts our early college and career program on its campus. We provide many opportunities to take College Now classes in our high schools for credit. And we even have some college instructors teaching courses in our high schools. 100 of our students spend their fifth year in high school taking a full load of courses at Lane Community College. And this year, we're sitting down with Lane Community College leaders to plan a transitional program for students interested in technical careers so that they can access LCC courses as juniors and seniors in high school. We also have a strong collaboration with the University of Oregon through an initiative entitled Connected Lane County, which has set a target of smooth and successful transitions from K to 12 to post-secondary education. There are other initiatives that will help, from expanding our STEM program, our science, technology, engineering, and math programs, to replacing our aging facilities, which we're in the process of doing, to replacing textbooks with interactive e-books. However, I believe the seven initiatives I've outlined for you are the most critical for moving Oregon education forward. Expanding early childhood education and implementing full-day kindergarten. Meeting higher expectations and more rigorous standards and assessments. Enhancing the capacity of teachers through high-quality professional development. Changing our strategies for closing the achievement gap. Reducing class size and special education caseloads. Lengthening the school year and the school day, and creating a seamless transition from high school to post-secondary education. How does this play out for Eugene? We're eagerly preparing for full-day kindergarten, working with our faculty members and administrators on meeting the more rigorous standards of the Common Core, providing powerful professional development for our faculty and our principals, expanding our after-school AVID and STEM programs to close the achievement gap, providing a more rigorous and full scheduler for our high school students to prepare them to be ready to graduate and be prepared for post-secondary education. Establishing an early college high school on Lane Community College campus and creating seamless post-secondary options, just to name a few. We have a great team of teachers and administrators who are making a difference for our students. The good news is that the governor, the legislature, and educational leaders across the state are moving many of these initiatives forward also. As a state, we're about to implement full-day kindergarten. The state has adopted more rigorous standards and assessments. The Oregon Department of Education is providing critically needed funds for professional development of teachers while setting growth expectations as part of our teacher and administrator evaluation system. The state is launching significant new initiatives in equity, and Oregon educators are working on creating a smooth transition to post-secondary education. Remember the statistic I mentioned at the beginning? Oregon is not only 45th in graduation rates, but 46th in graduation rates, but 46th in education spending. Clearly, we need the legislature in the next session to exceed the increase in education funding it provided in the last session, so that we can move all these strategic initiatives one step forward. We also need our community to rally in support of a local option so that we can sustain our own programs here in Eugene. That local option provides resources equivalent to 16 days of school and or 80 teachers. Much more needs to be done. The clock is ticking toward achieving 40-40-20. However, we are doing the right work and the signs of progress are there. If we do this work well, not only can we reach the 40-40-20 goal, but we can also reach into the upper ranks among states in the nation. Given how much Oregonians value education, this is both an appropriate and attainable target, and one that will help all our students succeed. So thank you for your attention to this, and I look forward to your questions about the initiatives that I've outlined. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berman. We'll move now to our first questioners. First comes Zelda Lopez-Haro, who is a member of the Education Committee of LULAC, and then Eric Richardson, who is president of the local NAACP, will ask a couple of questions.
Thank you, Dr. Berman. My question is, although you outlined a specific type of resources for the implementation of the Common Core, how will you make sure that these resources are getting to the schools that actually need them?
That's a great question. Thank you. You know, one of the things that we have instituted in Eugene is equity-based funding. We have a needs index that takes a look at a number of factors, including economically disadvantaged. We look at the students of color in a school. We look at the mobility of students in a school and also special education, a whole variety of factors that compose that. And we fund schools accordingly, so that those schools that have the highest need get the greatest resource. Now, I have to say that it is complicated because we probably could differentiate more adequately if we had more funding. But it is difficult to have very low class size in one school and have another school, although they may be somewhat wealthier, have much larger class size. But that's our commitment to move forward. And we've pursued that. So that's, and I think that's critical. The state also has an equity formula. However, the equity formula actually ends up compromising Eugene to a greater extent because, in fact, it's based on historic figures. It doesn't necessarily is not necessarily based on the economics of the district itself. So, but that's a great question.
So, thank you. So this is more of a request for information than a question. Basically, we're recognizing the changing demographics of our country and the budget squeeze that you're dealing with and the many issues, including trying to get to a 40-40-20. I understand that race is always an issue in education for the teachers dealing with people other than their own race and for the parents and students going into a situation they may be uncomfortable with. And I'm just wondering, as an organization that represents the concerns of the ongoing trends within the African-American, Latino, Native American populations that have to do with graduation rates, discipline rates, and the achievement gap, I would like to know what kind of investments, direct investments, the district does make in reaching out to parents, because you mentioned before, you know, in Oregon, our parents really don't have the high education that we would like to see, and that a lot of them struggle economically as well. So that to help them connect their students to the school, I'm just wondering, are there direct investments in that community, parent, school network? As an organization that deals with that, I'd like to see more of it, and so just wondering. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. You know, I would say a couple of responses. One is that The old saying, it takes a village to raise a child, it really does take an entire community. And we have to collaborate closely with community organizations and have partnerships with community organizations that are doing this work. And we have I know that George Russell, who was previous superintendent, initiated this many years ago. We have an equity committee that spends a great deal of time looking at how we can build a bridge to the community. We have established what we call an equity lens to look at our own work through the issue of are we being equitable and not equal, but equitable and addressing the needs of all students. We also are developing what we call an equity scorecard to take a look at what are the differences in discipline. What are the differences in our performance, graduation rates, and even in achievement gap scores, so that we can chart those and chart our progress and make sure that we're responsible to the community for reporting those results. So that is work in progress. We've also initiated over the last number of years, and I want to acknowledge Carmen Urbina for her work in this, our parent liaison, and she has been working with others to do home visits. We have done 150 home visits each year for the last 3 years. And this is the connection between family and school is key. I know NAACP did a parent conference last year, and I think LULAC was in collaboration with that as well. It's vitally important that we bring organizations like NAACP and LULAC together to work with us as in partnership so that we are able to reach parents most effectively and to help them feel comfortable at school. We've had a number of initiatives. I was pleased we had a parent meeting just last night for parent leaders. And one of the parents from North Eugene High School reported that there was a Latino parent organization that had developed at North Eugene. And I thought that was a great movement forward. The person spoke and she said, you know, we have different ways of participating and different ways of raising funds and different ways of connecting to the school, and this allows us to do that. But we need to respect that there are a variety of ways of connecting, whether that's through organizations like yours or whether it's through parent community. We need to build those relationships. And so if you're asking what can you do, what can we do, we can partner, and you can continue doing parent conferences, and we'll do our best to share in that work.
Thank you for seeding the discussion. We'll take a break for a few minutes now, anyone at the table and discuss our questions for the rest of the program. Remember that anyone at the table can participate in the discussions, but only members can come to the microphone and ask the questions when we come back. Thanks so much.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Welcome back to the September 19th City Club program, What Will Move Education Forward. Our guest speaker is Superintendent Sheldon Berman from Eugene School District 4J. Members, please come to the point of your question quickly, within 30 seconds, so that we can accommodate lots of questioners. Thanks so much.
Okay. Yeah, Frank Carlton, member since 2003. I guess I'm a little disappointed that there's no TV channel doing any of this. Is there anybody here from the newspaper? Oh, good. Okay. Glad to hear that. But anyway, my question is, this presentation seemed like it ought to be put in the newspaper or on TV or something. Is there any plan to do this?
Well, thank you. That's a real compliment. Okay. Thank you very much for that. I don't know that there's a plan. I'd be glad to share it with others and be glad to even send out a copy if requested.
Okay.
But thank you for that.
Thank you.
That's a real compliment.
Bob Cassidy. One of the controversies over a period of time has been in 4J, has been the charter school issue. On the national scene in education, there seems to be an attempt to turn public schools over to private education. Chicago comes to mind. as they are doing this through the charter school system, thus making for smaller classes and more select students. In the past, 4J has guarded against this. My question is, what is 4J doing now to avoid the problem of the disparity between these schools? And how is it working? Are charter schools in Eugene increasing the inequity?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, I want to frame this by sharing a little bit of my own background. When I was in Massachusetts, I headed up a task force looking at charter schools in Massachusetts. I was superintendent there for 14 years and president of the Superintendents Association. And in Massachusetts, charter schools were actually very destructive to the public school system. They were very well funded. They were able to discourage students who had special needs, students who were English language learners. In fact, there were virtually no English language learners in any charter school in Massachusetts. And there were very few special needs students in charter schools in Massachusetts. And if a student was a discipline problem, there was often this sort of counseling session charter schools would have with that student or the parent saying, you know, we could expel you or we could suspend you for what you just did, or you could just withdraw and go back to your public school. So, and then in some states, the funding is extraordinarily skewed towards charter schools. So I would say that on the one hand, in the national movement, you're absolutely right. The national movement is a privatizing movement, and I'm very concerned about the charter school movement around the country. The other fact that there's a huge Stanford study of about 3,000 charter schools, and they found that only about 17% of the charter schools outperform, the students in charter schools outperform the schools from which they were drawn. And there were about 34% that underperformed. So, in fact, charter schools don't necessarily outperform. But I do want to say that there are two things here about Oregon. One is that, and particularly about Eugene, we have had a steady number of charter schools. We've had a good relationship with our charter schools. We've had, actually, and they have served particular purposes. So, in fact, and the funding in Oregon, the two things that make Oregon different. One is that the funding comes through the district and is distributed to the charter school. So in fact, as an elementary school, the elementary schools here, Ridgeline, Village, Coburg, get about 80% of the per pupil expenditures that the district gets. So that's actually a fairly equitable formula. High schools get about 95%, which I think is somewhat more marginal because of the way it's funded. But in fact, whether it's network charter, which has a particular role and has taken an attitude of we're going to take on some of the challenging students who are not comfortable with the comprehensive high school, and we're going to do really profound work with them, or whether it's a Montessori or Waldorf school, which is the other two concepts that we have here, or a rural school that wanted to stay in existence, I think we've actually found a good balance here. So I want to just say that I think we're a model of where it has been appropriate and there's been good decision-making around this. There's always a risk. I think that there's, in Oregon, there's been a relative balance, but that doesn't mean that that's a balance for the national movement around charter schools. You know, I would say that my belief, I'm very committed. I've spent my whole life in not only education, my own education, but all my work has been in public schools. I'm deeply committed to public schools because of the democratizing, you know, element, the democratizing influence that public schools have of bringing people together. So as long as we can continue that, as long as we can ensure that our charter schools are equally balanced, and in fact, even here, our charter schools perform no better, no worse than our other schools. The other thing I would say is we have a responsibility. Charter schools arose out of a desire to have competition with the public schools, and we have to demonstrate that we can produce results. And so in some ways, I think as long as we sustain a strong program, we can sustain that commitment and people's commitment to the public schools. So I think there's a balance. So I want to say there's a balance, and I think it's maintaining that balance and ensuring that balance statewide that it's going to be important so that we do have charter schools. We respect that they serve a particular purpose, and at the same time, we don't move to a point where charter schools are compromising the integrity and the quality of education and public education.
Jerry Smith, City Club member, retired social worker. I wanted to thank you for the wonderful goals that you set forward, and I'm awfully glad you're there. I was hurt as an Oregonian, as American, to see how little our state has funded the needs of children. It's just abysmal. I bet Guatemala's doing better. I know Cuba's doing better. And that doesn't make any sense to me. Someone just told me that rich people from all over the country are moving to Oregon because they won't be taxed. And that makes me mad as hell. And that my question is about economics. What is the poverty level in among the children you teach? And how many of the children are homeless? And I think it's really excessive.
I think you're right. Much has changed, and it's important to set this in perspective. You know, 15 years ago, the percent of students, maybe 15 to 20 years ago, the percent of students who were economically disadvantaged in Eugene was about 15%, around 15%. It is now 43 to 44%. So we have the community has changed dramatically. The same is true with students of color as well. At one point, it was 15 years ago, it was about less than 10%. It's now about 30%. So we are a different demographic than we've had. But to get to your point, the funding system in Oregon is broken. Measure 5 and Measure 50 really undermine the quality of education. You know, when you look back, Oregon, and I said this earlier, in the 1990s, Oregon was in the top, well, it was 15th in 1997 among states in funding for education. And it has really sunk to a pretty low level as a result of that, those two provisions that are a part of our Constitution now. We have to change funding to education. The system is clearly broken. Even in Eugene, where we have a local option, the local option, if there's a whole system, and I won't describe it because it's too complicated, but if we were able to get the right value for that local option, we would be raising about $20 million as an addition to our base of revenue from the state. However, through something called compression, which reduces that amount and set by Measure 50, a cap on what can be raised locally, we can only raise about $8 million. So, and because of the dynamics, we've lost in the local option, we've gone just from four or five years ago from $14 million to $8 million, which is in a size of a budget that is $150 million. That's a huge impact. So the system is broken, and I know, frankly, I believe that the governor is committed to fixing that system and finding an alternative. We'll see what happens in this next legislative session. I think there's going to be a very serious campaign for additional resources. It is critical, and it's critical that people like yourselves let our legislators know that this is unacceptable. You know, having been in Massachusetts for 30 years, the statement from business leaders in Massachusetts is the investment in education pays off. You have a well-educated workforce, you have a respected community, companies come to you, have a well-informed electorate, you make better decisions. People value education and want to come to a place that values education. And we have to make that statement that we value education and put it up as a primary value, both for our in our spirit, but also in our funding.
The other part of my question, how many kids come homeless?
Good question. I'm looking at Carrie Delft, do you remember the numbers? I don't remember the numbers, but there's a pretty significant percentage.
About 7,000, isn't it?
Pardon?
7,000?
No, that's
Dan,
too high.
He's given us that.
Yeah.
It's close.
Go
to
ahead.
That. My name is Ruth Daimler, and I certainly agree that we need more funding. That is an important thing. We also need good nutrition. I was a former home ec teacher, and I'd love to see some home ec teachers hired with an emphasis on nutrition because kids do not believe in it. We have more pre-diabetics now than we've ever had. Their health costs are going to be multiplying until where money's going to go to cure their diabetes and their health problems. We need it in school and nutrition. In China, they found in Beijing that in the poorest sections of the community, they started providing great breakfast and great lunch, and also emphasizing that every child ate good breakfast and good lunch, and the scores went way up in education. And I hope we can do that. I was thinking Michelle Obama was, she certainly sent us in the right direction, and I hope that maybe we can do more. I was wondering if the school was, I know you do have a breakfast program, could you say something about it and how we can emphasize better nutrition for our kids?
Right. In fact, we not only have a breakfast, we have a lunch program and a breakfast program. We're doing a lot around both local, purchasing local, looking at more fruits, vegetables. Our food service program has done, there's a group called Kids Food Matters, mm-hmm. and has worked closely with us to raise the bar so that we're providing healthier lunches and breakfast. And in fact, in some of our schools, because the poverty level is as high as it is, we are now not even asking who's free and reduced lunch. It's a whole school program, and breakfasts and lunches are available to the entire school. So we're doing a lot in that area. In fact, probably in about 2 months, we're going to put up on the web, we've found a new application that will actually allow parents to look at every meal, see the ingredients in every dish that's there, and the various food value in each
just of them. Just so my grandkids get it.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Hi, Manuel Mejia, LULAC Youth Council President and City Club member. Traditionally, marginalized communities are typically fiercely underrepresented in the curriculum. My question is, how exactly do you plan to integrate these communities in the curriculum? And I want to specifically hear, as a student that graduated in 2013, how do you plan to integrate culturally competent teachers?
That's a great question.
And staff.
Thank you. You know, there is a lot of focus right now on what our curriculum offers and how it is, that communities aren't posed in stereotypical images, that we actually have the history of the various communities that make up our community and share the richness of those histories. I think our teachers are working a lot on that, and so it's been an issue in the district, and we've been talking a great deal about curriculum revision. We also have, and this has been going on for quite a long time, I want to credit George Russell, our previous superintendent, with starting this. We have a program for administrators in cultural competence. We have a program for teachers in culturally proficient teaching. We have probably well over 50% of our teachers have gone through it, and actually most of our administrators have gone through the program. It doesn't stop there, because the question I ask is, it's not only about having an awareness of culture, it's also about delivering that in the classroom. And so we are now asking, what does it mean to be culturally proficient teaching? What does culturally proficient teaching mean? What does it look like when we get to the classroom? And those are the questions we're posing now, and this is an ongoing work, but you raised a really important point. We're working on that. I can't say we've reached a conclusion, but that's something that we're taking very, very seriously. So thank you for the question. Joan.
My name is Joan Obie, and I'm a member of City Club. And so you already addressed the funding, the problem, but how likely is it that the 40-40-20 will be met without a reset of the way we fund schools and public services?
You know, I absolutely think that is a critical component. You know, too many times, one of the reasons I focused on the other seven initiatives is that, frankly, each one of them costs money. You think about class size, you can't reduce class size without funding education at a different level. That is about more teachers in more classrooms. So we have to fix the system, and that has to be, we have to press on that until the legislature says we need to do something different. I know that the governor had been convening both business leaders and labor leaders to talk about what could be done. There is a resistance to a sales tax, I understand, in this state. But maybe there are some other tools and other strategies that we can get behind. But I think you're absolutely right. To reach 40-40-20, we are going to need to restructure our funding to education.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off for the last decade. You touched on the topic of the transition of testing between the old standards and the new standards. And I had the luxury of tutoring a student in math this last year, so I looked at those two tests for math, and I really acknowledge that there's a really difficult transition there that's going to adversely affect the scores that people have to get into college. Could you give us some more details on how you're handling that transition?
Sure. There are two things to say, though. In the early years, there's an understanding that this will impact proficiency rates. So there's a realignment that the state is going to look at the results from the current, or an alignment between the current test and the previous test, and not change the cut scores so that it doesn't necessarily impact students getting into college by reducing their passing rates. That will change over time, and it'll become much more rigorous, and it will be more challenging for future classes as we move on. We're doing a lot. Well, first of all, let's give you one example. And the example I'll use is of our math curriculum. In general, math has been taught as, here's the algorithm, here's the way, the procedure, here are a set of practice problems, do those problems, and you'll learn to understand the procedure. There was not an understanding of why you did that procedure. Like, why do you solve linear equations? You know, what is a linear equation in the first place, and why do you solve it? But you solve it, all right? I got it, you know, I understand that here's how I plug in the numbers, and here's how I do it. So we had a lot of students who were proficient at procedures, but not understanding the math. What we have now done is we've now integrated a new middle school and high school program that actually is very aligned to the Common Core. And it starts with real-life problems that may result in the students using a linear equation to try to resolve that problem. So we're starting with to reverse the whole way we teach, so that we start with significant problems, have students work through those problems, understand the problems, and understand the mathematics behind it. You know, when I was, one of the struggles I had as a math student, and I actually got all the way through at calculus, was understanding why. And I kept on asking why, and my teachers will always be upset. You know, why are you asking why? Just do the procedure. But now we're teaching why. And that's the key difference. There's also a difference in reading, by the way. One of the things that's happening in reading, the major changes in reading, the complexity of tests, complexity of the text, it's changing the amount of nonfiction reading that students are expected to read. We have some major changes there. And in fact, just yesterday I met, we have our reading program, our Basel reading program, is still very traditional. And I met yesterday with the distributors of it who talked about an update that'll change the whole program. And I said, so how much of the program changes? And the individual said, you know, when I look at what you bought just 8 years ago, there's 75% of it is brand new, and it's a completely different approach. So we're in a new arena with a very different way of teaching that we have to pursue. And our teachers are, that's what we're doing in professional development, that's what we're doing all year long. And frankly, once teachers see the test, they understand that we're really in a new arena, and we have to take up a very different challenge. So we're working on it.
Hello, Veronica Amaya, City Club member since 2013. I have a two-part question, just one following up with this gentleman asked you about the cultural sensitivity training mm-hmm. for staff and teachers. About what percentage would you say, or is there any actually minority members in the personnel that is making the decisions of how to, in fact, approach this cultural diversity and training and sensitivity?
Well, I believe about, and I have to get the statistic right, about 10% of our staff are individuals of color. So we are now, and so they're very involved in this process. We've actually had a good deal of engagement. We have our parent liaison and an equity committee facilitator is an individual of color who has actually been very much a leader. She sits on the cabinet with me, the superintendent's cabinet, and has been very influential in providing leadership in all of those areas. We have to do a better job of recruiting individuals of color to our district. All districts do, by the way. And that's, we have actually started a significant recruiting effort. One of the things that has helped us, interestingly enough, is having two Spanish immersion programs, which are very strong and very popular. And we've actually changed them somewhat to be much more inclusive of native Spanish speakers. So we're actually getting more candidates coming to us. And what I've said is that we need to have bilingual teachers, not just in our two Spanish immersion schools. We have to have bilingual teachers in all our schools, every elementary school. And that's going to, we're in California, Arizona, Texas. We're going to be doing recruiting pretty broadly.
My second question, sorry, was I know that we're supposed to be implementing a full-time kindergarten in 2015.
Yep.
But I'd also heard that we don't actually have the financial means to accomplish that goal.
Well, we're all hopeful. I would say this. We're all hopeful that the legislature will provide the additional resources for full-day kindergarten. I'm actually relatively confident that as a legislator, you can't say we're going to double the time the kindergartners are involved in education and in classrooms without at the same time saying we're actually going to give you money to do that. You know, because otherwise you're just taking it away from all the other kids.
So I have to say math is changing at fourth grade too. My granddaughter engaged me in the part there at her worksheet actually said the adult needs to answer this question. And yeah, we had to talk about how we're solving a problem. How does our mind work around it? Okay, so this is about partnership.
Want to say who you are?
Mary Layton. Thank you. I always forget this part. Mary Layton, City Club member since 2006. City Club of Eugene is sponsoring a free course for teachers again this year. In partnership with Lane ESD and Lane Workforce Partnership, we designed an experience that focuses on the role of healthcare careers in our economy and the opportunities for employment. This course is free for teachers who may earn professional development credit or University of Oregon credit. Have you gotten our flyer on this? Have you shared it with your teachers? We still have openings.
We think it's very exciting, and thank you for offering it. And yes, we share it with our teachers. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berman, for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program, What Will Move Oregon Forward. And thanks to our questioners as well for helping to broaden and deepen our understanding. Thanks as well to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Essex General Construction, and KRVM. We meet next week twice, on Tuesday, September 23rd, from 5:30 to 7:30 at Cosmic Pizza for Street Art in Eugene, a public forum, and again next Friday. Now, if you'll notice on your little cards on the table, we have listed that Mary Wood will be speaking with us. That's been rescheduled because we're going to be hosting Senator Ron Wyden next Friday here at the DAC, who will be talking about privacy in the 21st century. So thank you all very much again for joining us, and we hope to see you at our next events.